This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Okay, welcome back then, everybody. It's time to ask our readers some hopefully interesting questions. I've been racking my brains trying to think of something to ask them. Actually, the thing that occurred to me, Joe, when you were reading your story is, how long did you actually live in California in order to write that?
Through the use of time travel, 50 years. I've never been. I really want to go.
No, that definitely had the old Silicon Valley startup vibe there, which I really did enjoy. I did notice on the way through, of course, that you had these references to the Four Non Blondes, which also is a very Silicon Valley thing. But I guess you did get that from the karaoke scene in Sense8.
I haven't even seen Sense8, but it sounds awesome. I got that from the karaoke on Saturday. I think Sam put it on.
Yeah.
So, but good choice. Did you get it from Sense8?
No.
Oh. But maybe you have always already got it from Sense8. Yeah.
Well, it is a very popular karaoke song, so I'll give you that one. Now, time travel, of course, is absolutely set about with all sorts of paradoxes and conundrums and goodness knows what. So I guess it makes a very interesting thing to put in a story. And so you can have lots of weird things going on, but your lot seem to take it to an entirely other level with like nanoseconds and replacing baby Hitlers and cloning baby Hitlers and goodness knows what else. It's sort of a little over the top, maybe. Lovely.
I sort of reused the same conceit in another story, and it's the same kind of time travel as copy-pasting, but they copy the whole planet onto the other side of the sun. So that's over the top.
But there is another copy of the planet on the other side of the sun, isn't there? I'm sure I've read that on the internet somewhere. Oh, dear. Scott, turning to you for a moment, you left us there with two cliffhangers, both of which ended with, they're all going to die. Could you possibly set people's minds at rest?
No. Because that would be boring. Read the novel when it comes out, and for the second one, nah. I might tell the whole thing one time. Eventually, but for now, no. We'll leave it as a cliffhanger.
But you said the second one was for an anthology. So is that coming out at some point?
It was for an anthology. Doesn't mean it got accepted. it was one of those.
Darn, I'll have to come up with a Cthulhu-themed anthology or something. It's Tentacles Over Bristol or whatever. Something like that. What about the novel then? Is that going to see publication at any time soon?
Probably about the same time as George R. R. Martin finishes Winds of Winter. No, it's the first draft is finished and it's now being reviewed and edited and mashed into shape and made much less rubbish than it currently is. So hopefully a year, 2 years, 3 years, about the same time George R. R. Martin finishes Winds of Winter.
Poor old George. Everybody's on his case. Don't you know that the American football season started this weekend? And he's a huge fan. Dear am I. Can't the guy have any time off? Anyway, Joe, is your story published anywhere? Have you got other stuff published where people might go and look for it?
That one's on the internet, so, yeah.
URL?
www.google.com.
All right. The trouble is that if we Google kill baby Hitler, we're going to... maybe kill baby Hitler time travel, I don't know. No, that would still get you 20 million hits. It's It's one of those things. Alrighty. Has anybody else got any questions for our readers?
Okay, so after, say, like the 12th time you've killed baby Hitler, why didn't they change their game plan instead of, like, you know, as I was saying earlier, why not start capturing baby Hitlers? And then eventually, after you keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it, you have a couple dozen baby Hitlers. And then you release all the baby Hitlers out into the wild. And then who's going to take Hitler seriously, because there's like a couple dozen of them running about anymore? And how would he ever grow up to be, you know, the Führer?
Okay, I don't know who this guy is, but he's totally hired.
He came with you, Jeff. I'm sure there's a Star Wars novel about this somewhere. Darth Vader recruits a clone army of baby Hitlers or something like that. Exactly. Yes, cloning is totally a Star Wars thing. Clone armies, all that sort of stuff. Any other questions for people? Yeah.
I'm mindful for turning up late, but I was just going to ask Scott. It's a Celtic sort of tribe that they go and see, but they're pagans. Is that those things? So,
without wanting to give the game away too much, although it's blatantly obvious, as far as Æthelflæd is concerned, or more Simon's concerned, they're pagan. They've gone a long way beyond pagan into the realms of just sheer blasphemy and horror. So whereas paganism is what the original Britons believed, this is way beyond that.
It's kind of easy to explain with local geography. So Simon is a monk from Glastonbury Abbey, which is in Somerset. And clearly, now Dunster is mentioned as well. Somerset is clearly the civilized part of the world. And what these poor people have done is gone over the border into Devon. That will get me into all sorts of trouble.
Especially as I've worked there.
You're not stationed in Plymouth by any chance, Scott?
At the moment, no. No, working in near Exeter at the moment.
Ah, right, yes. Yes, naval places near Exeter. I know all about that. I used to have friends who were there. Yes, interesting people. Right, yes. There was another question over here, yeah?
This might be quite an offensive question for a writer, but how influenced have you been, Joe, by Stephen Fry in this particular... Have you read his book about Hitler? So Stephen Fry wrote like a popular novel about going back in time to... So you're not influenced at all, is basically you've answered the question. He wrote a book about going... Has anyone read that book? About going back in time and killing baby Hitler? And they make... They put... You might want to read it. I'm just putting that out there. But they make all the men in the town that he was conceived in infertile. And then, you know, they go back to the future or something, and it turns out some even worse person than Hitler became the Führer or some kind of stuff. But anyway, you should maybe read that just for reference.
I hate reading.
Yeah, having to read all those things, that's awful, author people, right? I don't know. Oh, dear, yeah. No. Well, yeah, there's so many people have written stuff about killing baby Hitler these days, it's hard to keep up. It's a bit of a trope. But I bet you Stephen Fry's book didn't have pumpkin spice latte in it.
I think it has a Starbucks reference, I'm not joking about that.
Oh, dear. Any more questions for our readers? Oh, dear, I have to think of some myself. Scott, yeah, there was a Cthulhu anthology. Was that something that you just spotted that was of interest, or are tentacles a bit of a thing?
Bit of both. I'd be lying if I said I didn't have a very, very big soft spot for anything vaguely related to Lovecraft and the Cthulhu mythos, and tentacles are awesome. But the anthology was literally just something I saw posted on, I think actually Pete Sutton might have posted a link to it. It was called Swords versus Cthulhu, and it was about taking on the might of Eldritch horrors with sharp, pointy things. And the vast majority of the stories in it end in fairly obvious ways, but given that vast, pointy things and elder gods don't tend to mix very well.
Presumably they end in sushi. I think possibly the elder gods have their own version of sushi, which involves humans. And, yeah. So there you go. Yeah. Joe, are there other stuff that you might have written that we might be able to find? You mentioned having done time travel again. Is that a thing for you, or do you do all sorts of things?
There's a thing. The most recent thing that's available is in the long plus short, and it's called Froggy Goes Piggy. And it's probably, I would like to see if it's more or less horrific than your story. Yeah.
It sounds like Muppet porn.
That's prescient. That's insightful.
Oh dear.
And the airship, Scott, the novel clearly has an airship in it. It also has ritual chases and Chinese brothels. So can you tell us a little bit more about the story?
Yeah, it's a fantasy. It's basically a Victorian historical fantasy with elements of folklore and random silliness that I cobbled together and threw in because I thought it was fun. And basically tells the story of a young guy who works mining ether out of Glastonbury. And he ends up going on a series of adventures and basically taking on a giant corporation who are trying to mine the living energy of the world. And then there are fairies and horrible things and airships and lots of other stuff that goes on at the same time.
Yeah, I seem to remember fairies and explosions and things in Glastonbury in another reading that you... Oh, yeah, okay. Nothing quite like blowing things up. Yes, question here.
It's a kind of a comparative question for Scott and Joe. I noticed a bit of a difference in your writing that, Scott, it felt... I was very, especially this first story, drawn into the world, the specifics of how people were moving, where they were in space and time. It was very important, especially as a character kind of ends up bouncing away right at the end of the story. Whereas Joe, with the use of the third person, the you, I felt that you were drawing attention to the fact that it was an artifice, essentially, that there was a lot of humor and a lot of distancing in the story, that, you know, turning to the reader and saying, and now you're doing this, it kind of, at one point, kind of draws you into the story and also reminds you that it's this complicated tableau of kind of references and humor and so forth that you've created for us. So I just kind of wanted you both to talk a little bit about your process of writing and how much you want the reader to believe, I suppose, in what you're writing.
Thanks, Sam. you've slagged my writing off before for its lack of concreteness and its indecisiveness in time and space.
Well, I think it was a strong device. Like, just tell us why you chose that.
I think, yeah, well, I don't know. There's a constant layering of practices, and in that particular story, which was written very, very rapidly, I was working in a kind of quite comfortable space where I was doing things that are very easy for me, like dialogue, and perhaps because there was that time travel conceit, it seemed very appropriate that everything was sort of unanchored in time and space, and there wasn't a kind of strong sense of who was who was where. Although, this morning, while I was upstairs and you were in the garden, I did try and put in a little bit, because I was thinking about what you said, I did try to put in a little bit more concrete detail and sort of details of play, so it wasn't just a play, basically.
He's the Ivy Quantum Burnett of sci-fi.
Yeah, I want to jump to Joe's defense a little here, partly because I'm much more of a dialogue writer than a description writer, so I kind of feel your pain. But also, when you're doing something like that, you've got a whole bunch of characters in the story, And a lot of people would have spent time describing those characters, what they looked like, giving a bit of background on their lives, that sort of thing. You didn't do any of that. You gave those people character through how they spoke. And I thought that that was interesting and actually quite clever that you managed to pull it off.
Yeah. But I was well gels of that airship. It's like, you know.
So, Scott, you're good at doing description. How on earth do you manage it?
I don't know how many other people do this, but when I read certainly sort of a prose or a novel, I tend not to actually read words. I translate what's on the page into basically a film in my head. I make all the descriptions myself. It's one of the reasons why I can't physically, to repeat a theme, I can't watch the Game of Thrones TV show now until I finish reading the book, because I'm so invested in what the characters look like in my head that to watch Maisie Williams or Sean Bean play them on the screen would just mess with my perceptions. And when I write, it's the same. I don't actually sort of sit down and think, what are people saying if she says this? I just let them run in my head, and I let the scenes run, and I try and frantically scribble down whatever's going on. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then when I read it back through, if I can recreate that image, if I can recreate that scene, I've done it right. If I haven't, then I go back to the original, try and start again and do it again. And basically try and write almost what I'm seeing in my head rather than writing words.
Difference between somebody who's writing from a very visual point of view and somebody who's writing more from a point of view of hearing stuff, maybe. Joe, any comments from that as an editor?
As an editor, while I'm not going to fault anybody's process, because everybody's process is different and everybody has a different way of going about it, I will say that I do the same thing as Scott. And you can end up just writing reams and reams and reams of stuff that is completely unnecessary. I think we can all see Scott's face now. Reams and reams and reams of stuff that's completely unnecessary that has to then be ditched by your editor because you've written 14 pages of just describing the outside of an airship and how it works that nobody ever needs to see ever, 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 Scott. So there are disadvantages to that approach. As I'm sure Scott will agree.
This is why you never bring your editor to a reading.
Sorry. I should never ask that question again.
It's all right, because Scott earned his superhero nickname through doing this. And what is your superhero nickname, Scott?
Exposition boy.
Yes, by the power of exposition, I compel you. There's only one person I know that's better at exposition than you are, and that's Kim Stanley Robinson. Now, that's a high bar to aspire to, so, yeah, you should totally go for that. Alrighty. Do we have any more questions for either of our readers? No? Oh, Pete.
I guess the question then to Joe is, do you hear the voices in your head when you write? That came across a bit weird, actually.
All writers have voices in their heads.
Yeah, they're telling me to do stuff right now. Yes, when it's working.
Yeah, I have a very firm idea of what every character, again, sounds like and what and how they speak and what they say. I'm just not as talented as Joe, and I can't recreate them myself when I'm reading it out.
No, the Anglo-Saxon burr I haven't quite got yet. No.
Anglo-Saxon, yes. Mm. No, they probably sound quite Germanic, actually, Anglo-Saxons. Yeah. And as for those pagans over the border there, Alrighty. Any other questions? If we don't have any more questions... Have we got the announcements while we give Joe time to look up when the next Fringe is going to be? Pete, you know the date? Pete, have you got any announcements? Is there anything happening? No. You have a small one. Joe, announcement?
So there's a literary prize called the Sputnik Awards, and if you haven't voted in it, you've got one day left to do that. So go to that same website and type in the Sputnik Awards, and you'll hopefully find it.
That will be your website, right?
Google.
Yeah, Google. Yeah, no. Yes, no. The Sputnik Awards are a strange thing. You sent me an email about it, and I looked at them, and I thought, ooh, what? Yes. Any explanation?
So it's just a sort of experiment to see what happens. And they're kind of two themes, and one of them is the sort of soft pedal, let's think about what political, socially engaged science fiction and fantasy might look like. And the other one is thinking about democracy and social media and how we run prizes. So it's sort of an annex to the whole Sad Puppies Hugo's saga. But yeah, I mean, there's some, you know, there's stuff on the website, and there's some stuff in the latest Interzone about it, and yada 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 yada. But it's basically there's no kind of programmatic agenda. It's just an experiment to see what happens.
Scott's been looking up the website and tells us that Emma and Pete Newman have both been nominated for it. So, you know, perhaps can we go and vote for them? Is that the way it works?
I'm impartial.
Very good, yes. Very good, yes.
If we're talking about people voting for stuff, the voting for the Gemmels closes on Friday, and I know that Pete has been nominated for that as well. I'm not sure who else is on the short list. Some of us were on the long list, but we're not on the short list. But, you know, the short list is very, very good, and Pete is on it, so you should all vote for whoever you think like, as long as it's Pete. next month's Fringe is the 19th of September, and we've got Cassandra Cole and Jonathan L. Howard. And then October, there is no Fringe. And why is there no Fringe in October?
Bristol!
Thank you. So there will be an open mic on the Friday night at BristolCon if anyone wants to turn up and just read for 5 minutes or have an instruction in how to read good with a microphone. I think that's all my announcements.
Hey, how am I going to top last year at the open mic? Yes. On the subject of awards, there's a small convention happening in Kansas City in America at the weekend, at which one or two pointy chrome rocket things might be getting given out, and one or two no awards might also be getting given out. And as is traditional, Kevin and I will be doing the text-based coverage from the Hugo Awards website. That means doing it live during the Hugo Awards ceremony, which starts at 2 o'clock in the morning, UK time. And if I have to be up for it, the rest of you can damn well be up. Except, of course, it will be available because it's text-based, and you can just read through it afterwards if you really want to. However, yeah, for people in Australia that can't be there, it's all going to be fun.
I'm not staying up till 3 o'clock in the morning just to boo Vox Day. Okay, I don't think that man should be depriving me of my sleep.
Dear, there is that, yes. But hopefully there will be one or two interesting and entertaining winners along the way as well. Anybody else got any other announcements about interesting, exciting things happening in the field of science fiction, fantasy, murdering people and then eating them? No. Okay, well, in which case, I think we are done, and we will reconvene next month for Jonathan L. Howard and Cassandra Cole. Okay, good. Right. Okay, thank you very much, everybody.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.